This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Episode 90 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am your host, Aaron Campbell. My guest today has done a little bit of everything when it comes to magic. He was a pro player turned lead developer turned Hall of Famer turned commentator, and he's also a husband and a father. He is Randy Buehler. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I am a huge fan of yours, I just have to say.
Thank you.
I think you have a lot of energy, and I look forward to getting to know you a bit better tonight.
Sounds like fun.
Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. So the main thing I want to talk about is your impact on coverage. And people say that you have single-handedly made event coverage better. And I'm one of those people, actually, who feels that way. How does it feel to hear something like that?
Oh, it's really nice to hear. I don't know if it's true, but it's certainly nice to hear.
Was that sort of your intent going into it? Like, were you somebody who was maybe watching at home and going, this could maybe be a little better? Or were you happy with the way things were and that's why you wanted to be a part of it?
Oh, I just always enjoyed talking about magic. I enjoy watching magic, and building stories out of magic coverage is just something I have fun doing. So when the opportunity opened up again, I was happy to dive back in.
Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that I personally love is your excitement. And even after all of these years, and even after everything you've done with magic, you still get excited about things. Like, I was talking about this with a friend the other day, and we were saying how much we love when you leave the booth and you will go walk around the floor and you'll come back a little while later and you'll either have some results or you will have an exciting deck that you've seen. And you're so excited to talk about it. And it's infectious, where we want to know what you found when you were out on the floor. And I think that's so much fun to watch.
I was wondering how well those segments worked. I always feel like I'm hopping in the middle of something. I'm not sure what was being talked about before, so I'm glad that's working out. Yeah.
No, I really enjoy that.
Magic is awesome. I enjoy watching it. There's always something interesting going on, and yeah, I certainly, I like trying to find what's that nugget that I can share? What's the sort of the summary? You know, it's easy to get bogged down in sort of all the details, and there's so many details in the game, but being able to sort of distill out that one nugget of interesting truth is something I like doing.
And even after all of these years, you've been playing for a long time, you still have that excitement.
It's still the best game in the world.
No, I think that's wonderful. I think we would sort of expect the opposite, that maybe you would be maybe a little jaded or maybe a little been there, done that, and you're still excited about it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially getting back into coverage after I've been away for, quite a few years, I don't know, 4 years mm-hmm. or so.
I think that's something that impresses me even about my friends who work for WotC. You know, whenever I go visit them in Seattle, they'll spend all day working on it, and they're tired. You know, they work a long day, and then they'll come home and be like, I'm ready to cube. And I'm like, and it's like you would think that they would just be like, I don't even want to look at another Magic card, but they will still go to an LPS draft, or they'll still go to a cube, or they'll still go to whatever, and they just never get tired of it. I think that's so amazing.
Well, I mean, the depressing reality is that you don't play as much Magic once you start working for WotC. You play more Magic. Like, I play more Magic since I left than I did while I was there.
Mm-hmm. So another thing, coverage is something that people feel very strongly about. And while there are people who might say that you're doing an amazing job, there might be people who feel very strongly and might say that you're terrible or the coverage is terrible. How do you deal with that kind of criticism?
Well, it comes in two flavors. I mean, you being around Magic for as long as I have, I mean, you have to develop a certain thickness of skin if you're going to wander into, message board forums or chat rooms or whatever. And so I certainly, and I always feel like there's the crazy people that you can never please. And so you kind of have to adjust. It's like, can you read the forum? And what I'm always hoping to do is, can I distract out who the reasonable people are? If there's, just the sort of reasonable people in, like, I don't know, the middle 50% of the audience or something. If they have a comment, it usually is something constructive, and it usually is something that I want to think about and figure out, can I do something better? Or they maybe just not quite get what I was going for, and maybe I can do that in a different way. So, I mean, it really depends. is this the, 20% that's just trolling for the sake of trolling, or is there something actually constructive behind this comment?
Mm-hmm. So do you read the Twitch streams? Do you follow the Twitter comments? Like, how deeply do you get involved with that?
It's hard to read the Twitch while commentating. I mean, LSV does it, actually. I see him. He's got, like, his laptop or his tablet or whatever, and he's got the Twitch stream up and running. And I find it distracting to try to follow the chat, or I don't know. Maybe I just haven't figured out what the best setup is. I mean, there's always some information there. Like, sometimes you'll miss something, and it'll be in the chat, and so being able to glance at the chat to see if you miss something is useful. I don't actually follow the chat while we're going live. Our setup just isn't – it isn't built such that I have a way to see the chat, and so I've never sort of added that to the system. In terms of Twitter, yeah. I mean, I certainly read all the feedback that anybody sends to me, and I'm – I follow enough of the sort of magic regulars that I feel like I see the commentary. I mean, Reddit's a place I've gone a time or two to also sort of get another take on what we're doing.
You're brave. I won't even brave Reddit. Yeah, I think I go to Reddit for my guilty pleasure TV shows. So I will go to Reddit for Pretty Little Liars.
Sure.
And I will go to Reddit for RuPaul's Drag Race because I know that they are the safest, areas where I won't be bombarded by some of the bile that people like just to fling. And you're brave for doing that.
I like feedback.
So, you do?
Absolutely. No, I definitely. Yeah. Part of the reason I do it is just to feel connected to this community that I've enjoyed being part of for so long. So, yeah, I definitely like the feedback.
Now, how do you – and I've always been curious about the commentators. How do you guys improve on what you do? Like, do you go back and watch the previous coverage? Do you maybe have meetings after the fact? Like, how do you guys work on that?
I'm not sure that there's a one answer to that question. I think everybody has their own stuff. I mean, for me – I try to make sure I'm playing the formats enough that I'm sort of fluent in what's going on. I actually find that just the more magic I'm playing, the more articulate my commentary tends to be. I mean, it's always, you have to always color everything. I mean, I'm obviously biased looking at my own work. I know that when I'm playing a format and I know the format really well, that's naturally going to lend itself. So, I mean, honestly, I feel like the best thing I can do to to get better at commentary is to just play more magic, which, oh no, how horrible, right?
Oh man, I gotta play tonight.
Exactly. No, it's actually nice to have an excuse to have to play.
Sure, sure. What I'm also really curious about is, we talked about everything you've done in your magic career and all the roles that you've played. Being a competitive magic player and being an R&D and being a commentator, do you feel that wearing all of those different hats helps you in your coverage?
Sure. I mean, it helps to have insights into how other people see things. I mean, I think that's part of anytime you're trying to tell a story, and for me, coverage really is, okay, there's this match going on, but how do I, what's the story? Well, how do I actually get people to engage with the content that's on the screen? What's the backstory? Maybe it's the decks, maybe it's the players, whatever, what that story is. I think that being able to see the world through other people's eyes helps you find those interesting stories. Sometimes it might be sort of a WotC or R&D-centric story. Sometimes it's player-centric. Sometimes it's, deck builder-centric. So the more perspectives, the better.
Mm-hmm. I love the little tidbits from R&D. Like, I was watching the Pro Tour Born of the Gods coverage, which was Modern, and I just started getting into Modern at that time, and you had made your list of, like, what you thought the top 20 decks were going to be.
Right.
I think it was 20, and they would bring up the deck, and then they would talk about, like, the behind the scenes. Like, this card was supposed to cost this much, or this card was supposed to be called this. I love that. I love those little glimpses behind the curtain.
Yeah, no, that was fun.
Yeah, and I feel like we don't really get that with a lot of other commentators. They haven't been where you've been. So you started playing Magic in college around Homelands, correct?
Yeah, grad school, essentially.
I have fond memories of Homelands. I know a lot of people don't love it, but I remember Baron Sanger and Autumn Willow and a lot of love for that set.
Yeah, no, Baron Sanger was cool. I mean, the set was just overcosted. The set that I have fond memories of that I think everyone else looks back on badly is actually Fallen Empires. I thought Fallen Empires was awesome. I mean, part of it may be that it had been so overprinted that it was cheap, right? I think the first booster display I ever bought was a $40 display of Fallen Empires. Like, I split it with, a friend, $20 each. We got a booster display, right? It felt awesome. I thought the flavor in Fallen Empires was pretty good. The biggest problem with the set was that all the good cards were common. Like, if Hymn to Torak and the Pump Knights had been rares, people might look back on it a little better rather than just seeing it as this overprinted monstrosity that wasn't worth anything.
Yeah, I definitely remember it being the cheapy set where, you know, that was the age where I was, you know, saving my babysitting money to buy packs of Magic. And I remember that was one of those where, you know, Ice Age was like $3.50 at the time. So it's like, yep, you would go with your babysitting money, and then whatever you had left over, you wanted to just keep cracking packs because you were at that age where you got the high just from opening them. So you would buy all the good packs you could, and then you'd scrounge for all the change you had. Like, well, I have enough for the $1.50 of Fallen Empires. Got to keep my high going. Here you go. And then you'd open a salad or something like that. I totally remember that.
My roommate and I had a 2 Icy Manipulator detente.
Oh.
We believed that Icy Manipulator was just the most powerful card. You wanted it in all of your decks. Every time you bring a new deck out, you'd have to go get the Icies out of the last deck and put them in. And yeah, we decided to just, rather than just keep spending and spending and spending to get more Icy Manipulators, we had a detente where neither one of us would, we both agreed neither one of us would try to track down any more. So I think 2-2 is where we stopped.
I was that was also the age of Chronicles, and I remember I had not been there for the original Legends and the original Dark. So again, being a kid, you know, I thought all these cards were super cool, and then people would tell me those are reprints, they're from these older sets, and then I would find cards like Preacher and, you know, things like that, and Ur Nam Dajin, and just, oh my god, it got me to explore these other sets that I'd never seen before, and it just opened a whole other door for me. So I remember all those sets very fondly. Except Alliances.
What was wrong with Alliances?
I just didn't. I didn't really get it, I guess. I can look back now and kind of see why it was awesome, but at the time it just didn't really. Ivory Gargoyle was kind of strange, and Balduvian Horde was kind of, like, it was, I think it was one of the better cards in the set.
Well, it was thought to be one of the better cards in the set. Everyone thought it was the new Juice Engine because nobody really figured out how bad discard a card was as a drawback.
That's very true. That's very true. But, and there was a card, I think it was Diminishing Returns, was it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and the new it was a new Time Twister. You had to remove 10 cards from your library.
Yeah. All this crazy stuff. So what was it about Magic that, or what about it piqued your interest in playing competitively?
Well, I mean, I've always been kind of a competitive person. I mean, I grew up, I did a lot of fantasy sports. I actually, the thing I did the most of in college was College Bowl, which is, I don't know, high school bowls, essentially academic competitions, you know, team Jeopardy. So I did that in high school. I did that in college. And it was actually, I was at a summer gathering of sort of, it's funny, the College Bowl scene is similar to the Magic scene in that you would have these friends scattered all over the country. You would only see them at tournaments. You would sort of interact with each other over the internet, and, you know, you'd kind of get to know people, and then you'd go to the tournaments and compete against them, and you'd form these friendships. So one guy every summer would actually host kind of a gathering, you know, 20, 30 people would descend upon this orchard up in Tennessee. And it was like his in-laws had an apple orchard. So we would move in, and we would essentially all bring buzzer systems. And so we're competing in this, you know, there's sort of this tournament that goes on over the course of the long weekend where you're competing and seeing, you know, it's essentially just showing off, but whatever. That's what we did. I go there, and so I go and I see these guys who are playing this game on the kitchen table, and I hadn't seen it before. It was Magic. And, you know, it's just, they're playing this multiplayer free-for-all game, and yeah, I was just, what's that? And they were trying to explain to me how it worked, and, you know, somebody handed me a deck, and I sat in and kind of learned there. And so by the end of the weekend, it seemed cool, and they sent me off to face the world with an all-commons deck. It was a black-white sort of pestilence black with pump knights in it, you know, the pro-black pump knights. So that was the deck. They sort of sent me off to face the world. I have this one deck. And I got back to grad school, and my roommate had actually – his roommate from the previous year had left behind like 100 cards. And so Jason had this pile of about 100 cards. I had this all commons deck that I'd been given, and we just got sucked in. I mean, for me, it started, it was the creativity. It was sort of this puzzle of building a deck was, I don't know, my first year or two, it was all about that, right? It was just sort of, I don't know, I guess I had a little more Johnny in me at the time. You know, deck building as this expression of creativity, and it was really solving the puzzle, and you wanted to build the best decks. I mean, it was definitely a competitive thing too. I'm mostly a spike. Once I discovered tournaments, and so I went through the 6 months of, you know, playing against my roommate, and basically we only played against each other, and then, you know, Del, my now wife at the time, she was my girlfriend, you know, she would have her cards, and we would play, and we'd invite people over. That lasted, I don't know, maybe 6 months or so. And then I discovered tournaments, and then it was all over. I get completely sucked in, and I discovered tournaments. I then quickly discovered sort of Usenet news groups and deck lists, and suddenly I was, you know, putting together necro decks and going to play PTQs.
Now, were you good at competitive Magic going into it, or did you have a couple – was there like a learning curve for you?
Oh, there was definitely a learning curve. Like I said, for 6 months I was a kitchen table player just because I didn't know any better. And then I had just started playing PTQs. I was in Minneapolis. I got my master's from the University of Minnesota. And so – but my wife was in Pittsburgh. She was at Carnegie Mellon. We had been undergraduates together at Vanderbilt. And so we moved off to different colleges, and that sucked. So I got my master's and transferred to Pitt and moved to Pittsburgh, got married, and – that's all worked out great. But meanwhile, when
and
I got,
she plays too?
She, at the time, she played a little bit to humor me. I mean, she certainly, I got her sucked in enough that she had a couple PTQ top eights back in the 90s when I was at the height of when I was playing. I mean, she was a grad student who wasn't in love with her thesis project or her thesis program, so it was kind of a distraction. But not, she's not the gamer that I am or the psychopathic competitor that I am, I guess. She works for Wizards of the Coast now, so, I mean, we'll get to that part of the story later, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, when I moved to Pittsburgh, I started seeking out who the good Magic players were. Like, I knew that this was something I wanted to keep doing, and so, you know, I went to the student union at the University of Pittsburgh, and it's multiplayer free-for-all games. And it turns out, by the way, one of the guys in those multiplayer free-for-all games is Aaron Forsythe.
Nice.
Yeah. But that wasn't, you know, I found, we went, yeah, Dell and I went to, it was actually a two-headed giant tournament. It was two-player teams. We went to this tournament, and I just got absolutely destroyed by this guy named Eric Lauer. And it was like, oh, okay, where do you play? And it was at Carnegie Mellon, you know, it was in a essentially a lobby in a building at CMU's campus. And so I went there, and that's really where my apprenticeship kicked into high gear. You know, I learned the game from Eric Lauer, Andrew Cuneo, you know, Chris Esko was the other sort of really good player at the time. But, you know, Andrew and Eric were just multiple steps ahead of me. I was the organizational guy, though. So I was like, oh, there's this PTQ in Philadelphia. Do you guys want to go? I've got a car. I'll drive. And so essentially just sort of dragged Eric out of his apartment and put him in the car and started driving him to PTQs and gray matter events. And, you know, that's where, you know, I was learning from those guys. And I was sort of, I guess it was me introducing those guys to organized play as well. And sort of we all got on the Pro Tour at about the same time.
Wow. And that reminds me, you know, I hear that piece of advice given a lot, where if you want to get better at the game, surround yourself with good players.
Yeah,
surround
yourself
with
better
players.
You have to find the players that are better than you and figure out what they're doing, that why they're beating you. Why are they winning more often? That's by far the most effective way to get better at Magic.
Yeah, that's very true. I remember there's a guy at my local game store, and I'll name him because that's what I do. His name is Connor. And I thought Connor didn't like me for the longest time. And I always described us as being sort of frenemies because I would always get paired against him at FNM, or I would always get paired against him at a GPT, and he would always win, and he was always really good. And I was just really bothered by him. And I just thought he was out to get me and everything like that. And then I remember I just kind of realized I was looking at it wrong. I was like, you know, you have the opportunity to learn from somebody local who's really good. He actually won a PTQ. He was at Pro Tour Theros, I want to say.
Cool.
And I was like, you know, I can look at this guy and think, oh, he's so terrible because he beats me all the time and he's such a jerk. Or I can kind of humble myself and say, what are you doing? What can I learn from you? And then he started giving me advice unsolicited. And that only made me think he was a jerk more. And then I was like, wait a minute. He obviously is trying to help me. And he and I eventually got to a better place where I understood. And when he would beat me, he would say, you probably should have tapped that. You probably should have done this. And I learned to appreciate that and not take it as an insult. And I feel like I got better for it. And that really is true.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So then you took 2 years off to pursue competitive Magic a bit more.
Well, you skipped a step in the story.
Did I?
Yeah, I won the Pro Tour. So,
oh, you won a Pro Tour. Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
okay.
I'm playing this game as a hobby, and it's fun, but it's a hobby, right? I'm working on my PhD. I've got my master's, working on my PhD. I fully expected to, you know, live the life of academia. I was supposed to write a thesis on the history and philosophy of quantum mechanics and go be a professor somewhere. So, sure, I'm in grad school. I mean, my notes have a lot of deck lists in them rather than notes on the classes, but whatever. I qualify for the Pro Tour. Finally won a qualifier, and I won the qualifier, you know, Mike Turian came to school at Carnegie Mellon that same time. He had won a qualifier, so he sought us out, and we're all sort of practicing for the Pro Tour together. So, yeah, I go to Chicago 97, and I put in a lot of work for that event. I mean, I wanted it to be that, you know, this was my first Pro Tour, and if I didn't succeed, I didn't want it to be because I failed to put the work in, right? I mean, if I wasn't good enough, okay, fair enough. Maybe I had more work to do on my game, but I was definitely going to put the work in, so we worked a lot. You know, we had multiple good decks, and anyway, we go, and yeah, I win the pros war. I come back to campus, and my professors are like, you won how much money? Do you know what we get paid? Why did you come back to class? Okay, that kind of makes sense. So, yeah, I took, you know, with $25,000 in my pocket and, you know, this sort of pro tour there is, I, at the time, people looked at Magic as probably a fad. Like, who knows how long it's going to be around for, right? So I figured while it's here, okay, yeah, I'll take a break from grad school and I'll be a professional Magic player. And so I started traveling to all the Grand Prix and, you know, just stopped going to class, started just going to CMU's campus with my deck, my box of decks so that we could be testing for the next event, whatever it happened to be.
Mm-hmm. So when you went, when you won that pro tour, what were you feeling at the time? Like, was there any sort of pressure to keep it going? You know, what was that like?
Well, sure. I mean, certainly there was some desire to prove to people that I wasn't just a flash in the pan who happened to get lucky. Yeah. I mean, I, nobody really knew who I was going into that. So I did want to prove that, you know, it wasn't a fluke and that I could do it again. And so, yeah, I mean, I made day two at the next pro tour. That felt good. You know, I finished pretty consistently well. You know, I made a bunch of Grand Prix top eights. I won a Grand Prix a couple months after the pro tour, maybe 6 months after the pro tour. So, I mean, I quickly became, you know, nobody was looking at me as a fluke because I was putting up multiple results. And then it was really a race to see, could I get player of the year? And halfway through the season, I was leading the player of the year race. And then, you know, this guy from New Jersey had, everybody knew he was good. He made his first top eight at my Chicago, and but he finally won his first pro tour in New York a couple events later. Then he made top eight at Worlds. And yes, John Finkel got player of the year that year. I got second.
I have to say, you sounded like you were really ready for your first pro tour. You know, I have had people on the show, and I've asked them that question, like, how did you prepare for your first pro tour? Mm-hmm. And some have been very diligent about it, and some have been very mellow, like, I just kind of showed up. And you sound like you had a really good plan, and you were really determined, and like, you wouldn't have been surprised if you won, because you worked that hard for it.
But you are always surprised when you win. I mean, my goal going in was to qualify for the next one, which was, at the time, you needed top 32 to qualify for the next one. I wasn't going to be surprised by that. I was going to be happy and, you know, content. You have to get lucky to actually win. I mean, you're always going to be surprised when that happens. I mean, a little bit.
So you make day two.
Sure.
And then you're happy you made day two. And then you went into day two thinking, again, you just want to qualify for the next one.
Well, sure. I mean, that was my goal. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. you never want to lose. One of the things, I felt like I was in a pretty good zone at that event where I knew my deck extremely well, and I knew everybody else's deck extremely well, too. I don't know. I may have gotten a little bit lucky there in that – so it was an extended format Pro Tour, and there had – extended had been one of the days at Worlds. The previous Pro Tour was the, you know, the 97 World Championships, the one, I guess, Jakob Schlemmer wins it. I knew what the top decks were from that extended day and had practiced against them a lot. And I actually got paired against some of exactly those decks. I mean, I played Janos Kuhn, who had played one of the big decks on the extended day and had a lot of success at Worlds. So I knew his deck. I had been practicing against exactly his deck, and he didn't really change it up. So I don't know. Maybe we had just innovated more on a metagame that was not well established, but, you know, we had all the decks in our gauntlet, and I had a lot of experience against all those decks. But it helped that I was able to just sort of focus on any given match. Like, I wasn't thinking about where I was in the standings. I wasn't thinking about, you know, how much money I could win. I was able to just focus on, okay, this game of Magic right here, what am I supposed to be doing?
And that's something I think a lot of us are guilty of.
Yeah, honestly, it got harder. Like, once I had the top eight and I was going to try to get the second top eight, it was a lot harder to block those sorts of things out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're all guilty of that. And even, you know, even somebody like me where I would kill for a tenth of that success, you know, it's even hard for me where you're, you know, I tend to get preoccupied with the tables. So, you know, I remember I was at SCG Milwaukee a year or two ago, and they literally had it where, like, the lower-end tables, like, the bottom rankings, it was, like, darker and colder and, like, shielded away. And I remember doing well, and I started off at, like, table 275 and, you know, or table 700 or whatever, and then I'm at table 500, and it's brighter and it's warmer, and I'm like, oh, this feels awesome. And then all of a sudden, I lost, and then I'm back to, like, 417. 15, and I'm back in the cold section. Sure. And once you get a taste of being at that top table or something and you lose it, you can't not think about it. At least I can't. And it's like, I just want to get back to table 47 where it's brighter and people can see my face. And I just, I get really wrapped up in that. I see the little card. It's like, oh, it feels so nice to be, you know, in a double-digit table. And I get wrapped up in that. I totally do. So did you have any goals when you took those 2 years off? Like, did you say to yourself, okay, I want to accomplish X, Y, and Z, or else I'll just go back to school? Like, what was the plan?
I don't know that there was a do this or I'll go back to school. It was more of a, well, this is here right now, you know, and I mean, at first it was prove it wasn't a fluke, but I mean, I pretty quickly put up a series of results where that wasn't an issue. And then it was, you know, I was always, I wanted to be player of the year. I wanted to be the first guy to win 2 pro tours. You know, those were the sorts of goals that I had. I mean, at some level, I also wanted to be acquiring enough dollars that I could actually support, you know, myself, my wife. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an explicit do this or else I'll go back to school, though.
Did you consider going? So the 2 year break, though, you were eventually going to go back to school, though, right?
I mean, I guess in theory, I'm still on sabbatical. My credits have probably expired by now. I'm pretty sure the credits expire at 10 years, but.
So you took the break, and then you just never looked back.
Yeah, I mean, I took the sabbatical, so I was a professional Magic player for a couple of years. And then, you know, I got to know the guys in R&D from doing that. You know, Mark Rosewater would go to all the events. You know, he was very careful not to hang out with players until after we'd been eliminated from the event. But, you know, once I'd get eliminated from the event, Mark and I would often go out for, you know, a dinner or, you know, a lunch on Sunday or something. And, you know, he's the guy that recommended to me that I apply for a job at Wizards. You know, and essentially recruited me on behalf of R&D. And this is, you know, I guess these conversations started happening, you know, into my second year. I wound up on the Pro Tour just a little bit into a third year. I played essentially two seasons plus 2 events. Yeah. But, you know, the end of that second year, I was already talking to people from R&D about possibly taking a job and, you know, I guess switching teams, trying to break the cards before they come out instead of after.
Was going to work for them everything you thought it would be?
Yeah, no, it was awesome. I mean, the environment there was just a bunch of smart people who liked talking about games. I mean, the reason I was in grad school is that I really liked arguing with smart people and about interesting things. And then I went to work, you know, and that's kind of what happens in the pit in R&D. You're arguing with smart people about interesting things. It turns out that pays a lot better than being a professor somewhere. So also more fun. Yeah, it all worked out great.
Did you fit in right away, or was there ever a moment where you were like, oh my God, I work at Wizards?
I think I fit in right away. I mean, they definitely had a lot of respect for me as somebody who was having consistent success on the Pro Tour. And so, I mean, I just was better at playing the game than anybody they had inside. I mean, they knew they needed to go hire people off the Pro Tour. I mean, if you look at the way Magic, the trajectory Magic had been on, you know, Tempest was probably too fast, and, you know, the dead guy red decks or red deck wins, whatever you want to call it, and, you know, Ball Lightning Fire Blast, just the game was too fast. And then in order to try to compete with Tempest, they printed Urza's Saga, and they just went and revisited all of the crazy combo cards, and they thought they were making weaker versions of them, and they were in fact making better versions of them. I mean, Time Spiral and Talarian Academy, and, you know, just you could kill your opponent on the first turn, so combo winner happens. It's like they was too fast, and then they went too combo, and then they knew they had messed up the power level of Standard, so the Mercadian Masks block comes next, and it's clear that somebody just said to R&D, we don't want to ban any more cards, you've got to back off the power level, you know, don't miss. And so they had a set where everything was sort of very carefully constructed to make sure they didn't miss again. But they didn't have the expertise in-house to be able to tell what the good cards were before they printed them. And it's obviously just an untenable place. So they went to the Pro Tour, and so I was, you know, the first of a wave of pro players who started coming in and really, you know, fleshing out the development aspect of R&D. I mean, they were good at design. They still are good at design, and it's some of the same people. But they really, the development piece of it, they had it philosophically. Like, I give Richard a ton of credit, Richard Garfield, the way he sort of set things up. He could have just been, this is my game, I'm going to make the cards I want to make, but he knew that you needed 2 sets of eyes to make sure the cards were actually good. You should have designers who make sure they're cool. You should have developers that make sure they're balanced. They just didn't have any, you know, they didn't have any developers that could play the game as well as we pros could play it. And so when I came in, I immediately got respect in that sense. You know, I remember sitting down to Invasion development meeting. Invasion was the first set that I worked on. And, you know, suggesting cards in the very first meeting that immediately went into the file. So that was kind of cool.
You also said something in your Hall of Fame profile that kind of reminds me of this. You said that Wizards staffs the company with its own customers so that you're able to channel what players will think or feel about various games or promotions and make it a good company to work for. It sounds like that was the case.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, R&D continued to hire a bunch of pros, and I mean, the design team isn't trying to hire off the pro tour. The design team is trying to hire, you know, the more creative guys from the customer base and the multiplayer players and whatnot. So absolutely, that's always been sort of R&D's DNA.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really unique perspective, I think, that, like you said, they don't get anywhere else. So,
yeah.
So one of my followers, I had asked for potential questions for you, and I've also heard this from other people as well. I think Kai Buddha, when I had him on the show, had made a comment along these lines. People have said that there seems to be a noticeable shift in direction from the time you were lead developer to the time our friend Aaron Forsythe took over. And one of my followers specifically had asked if you could do anything differently. If you were in Aaron's shoes right now, what would you do or what would you have done?
I have lots of
directions.
Yeah, no, I totally get the question. There's lots of different directions I can go with the answers, actually.
Okay.
I mean, my relationship, I'll start with my relationship with Aaron, which I actually enjoy. You know, I was talking earlier how Aaron was actually one of the guys in those multiplayer free-for-all games at the Pitt Student Union when I moved to Pittsburgh. And so the rest of his story, he actually, when I won the Pro Tour in Chicago, you know, he very famously said, "What, that guy won a Pro Tour? Randy Buehler won the Pro Tour? I gotta go start playing PTQs. If that guy can win, I could do well too." So it literally inspired him to start taking Magic more seriously because he was incredulous that I could win a Pro Tour. And yeah, he joins the team for Rome. So, I mean, Aaron's a great guy. I like Aaron a lot. Still hang out with him. He and I do have different takes on Magic. And so as players, I mean, I think you see some of this in the sorts of cards that get made. You know, my most iconic decks were, you know, Necropotence, Drago, things where you had essentially control of the game, right? You had the grip full of cards, you were planning everything out meticulously, and Aaron's signature deck is Angry Hermit, right? Angry Hermit is essentially a red-green ramp deck where you have a bunch of mana, you have a bunch of fast mana, and you have, you know, not a ton of threats, but when it works out great, it's spectacular, right? You get the mana into the awesome thing, and then suddenly you're plowing under their guys, you're making a deranged hermit. And so I like to think, you know, I think he plays for the top of his deck a lot more than I do. You know, he'll just like, okay, I hope this is going to work. I'm doing this awesome thing, and, you know, I'm hoping the top of my deck gives me the perfect card to deliver. And I never wanted to trust the top of my deck. You know, I always wanted to have it all planned out already and not have to rely on that perfect top deck. And I think you see a little bit of that in the way Magic has gone, in that, you know, Magic has gotten, I think, faster on his watch. Well, I'll start earlier in the story. So when I got to Wizards, it was clear to me that the spells were too good and the creatures were terrible. And so one of the things I was really trying to do while I was there was, I thought the lands were bad. I was trying to convince them to make better multi-lands, right? And there's just, everybody was playing monocolored decks because there weren't any, the dual lands were terrible and they didn't want to do cards that were strictly better than basics. I'm like, look, Magic is just more fun when people can cast their spells. So, I mean, it's funny, I look at it, the cards that I got into the invasion file right away, which I had to fight for, were the comes into play tapped, multi-lands, right? It's, like, that card's not even good, right? At the time, they thought it was above the curve. I'm like, no, this is just, anyway, if you're doing a gold set, you gotta have good multi-lands. So, you know, let's put these in, you know, and similar, like, Sarah Angel was above their costing curve too. I'm like, Sarah Angel's not even good. They took Sarah Angel out of the base set because she's too powerful. She's unplayably bad. It's just, big creatures have to be a lot better than you think they do. And so I do think that you start looking at, you look at Invasion and into Odyssey and Onslaught, and the big creatures got a lot better and the spells got a lot worse. And that was definitely, you know, a deliberate effort on my part. It's like, you can't give people Counterspell and Swords to Plowshares and then expect people to go play sort of medium and large creatures. It's just the spells and the answer cards are too efficient. So anyway, it was somewhat of betrayal, I guess, you know, taking the cards out that I had so much success with, but whatever, that's what I was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the one thing I might do differently, and I'm not even convinced I would do differently, but I do look at Magic now, and, like, the fast creatures have come back. I feel like the one-drop creatures and the two-drop creatures have just gotten a lot better. Like, big creatures got better on my watch, but I really wanted, you know, turn three and turn four to be the crucial games in Constructed in particular. And it looks now like they've got the weenie creatures are as good as they had ever been, even around Tempest, say. You know, Jackalpup is isn't even, you could print him nowadays, it would just look like another one of the one drops, right?
Yeah.
So on the one hand, that doesn't fit my vision for what I think the game should be. I mean, I want the game to be slow enough that you can have a hiccup in your draw. You know, your draw isn't perfect and you don't just run over and get killed. You don't just get run over and killed. On the other hand, I got to give those guys credit. Magic is bigger now than it ever was on my watch. Like, yeah. Magic has been growing by leaps and bounds, and I don't really have a good answer to the scoreboard defense, right? You can just look at the stuff that they're doing now. You can't, it's hard to know exactly what is contributing to the awesome growth of Magic, but, I mean, the game is doing really well, so maybe I was just wrong to not want those weenies and, you know, not want games coming down to, you know, turn three, you have to top deck the right card. I mean, that's just a more fun game.
Yeah. It must feel really good to have been with Magic when it was, again, it was doing well, but like you said, it has blown up in recent years, and to be able to sort of follow that trajectory, like, it must just blow your mind to be like, wow, Magic is this big, you know, when I played it was only this big, events were only this big, and now to see the 1,500, 1,900, 2,000 turnout at GPs must blow your mind.
No, it is awesome. I mean, on the one hand, yeah. In the back of my mind, there's always that little nagging doubt that, like, well, maybe it only got this big because I left Wizards.
No.
I don't actually believe that, I don't think. I mean, I certainly like to think, and I mean, I've certainly had conversations with the guys inside R&D. I feel like, well, I like to think that my legacy was helping Wizards get good at development. That, mm-hmm. you know, being able to print cards, you know, to not have to constantly ban things, to have sort of a group of people internally that know the game well enough that they can actually print sort of diverse and interesting sets. I mean, I think that that's the thing I like to see as my legacy, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I like to believe that they're doing so well now because they're building on top of something that I certainly helped lay some of the foundation for.
I would certainly agree with that.
Oh, I hope I'm not just deluding myself, but yeah.
No.
That's what I like to
I'd like to think I'm pretty honest, and if I thought you were, I'd be like, Randy Buehler, no.
Thank you.
So I want to talk about your legacy a little bit more. So you were inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2007, mm-hmm. and you said something very interesting that kind of caught my eye. You said, I'm totally serious about my desire to go back to the tour if I ever leave WotC, and I'm totally serious about playing in Worlds if they'll let me. My game is rusty right now, but I do believe that I'm capable of getting back into shape. Is that still true? Would you ever go back to playing competitively?
Yeah, I would. I mean, the problem is, when I left Wizards, I actually, like, on my way out the door, one of the things I was trying to negotiate for was for them to change the rules such so that I could play even though my wife still works there. I mean, the only reason I'm not playing competitive Magic is that my wife still has a job at Wizards, and she likes her job a lot, and I like my wife, so. But yeah, the rules say if your immediate family works for Wizards, then you're not eligible to play. Mm-hmm. So.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I can't. It sucks. I wish I could play, but I can't.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss it?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I do play Magic Online. I mean, Magic Online doesn't have the same sorts of, you know, it's not officially DCI sanctioned. It doesn't have all the same sorts of restrictions. But, yeah, I mean, I try to make up for Magic Online. I play a lot of board games competitively. I've been going to the World Board Gaming Championships every summer. It's just trying to find that competitive outlet to replace Magic. You know, I tried poker for a while, but, I mean, the correct strategy in poker is just too boring for me. So board games have helped. I've had some fun at that. But, yeah, I do wish I could play. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Is it just the competitive aspect that you miss, or do you miss the social aspect or the deck-building aspect? Like, what is it that you think about the most?
Well, I mean, you can replace some of it. The social aspect and not entirely cut off from, and especially mm-hmm. one of the awesome things about doing the coverage gig is that I do get to hang out at the events and, you know, do the late night drafting, and I feel like my social circle is mostly people that I know through Magic, so I haven't been cut off from that. I mean, I would certainly, that's a large part about what makes Magic so spectacular is the set of like-minded people that you wind up spending all your time with. But, I mean, that's not the part I'm missing in my life right now. Right now, what I'm missing is that competitive outlet that, mm-hmm. you know, everybody who plays every game. I mean, you even see, like, the way a lot of the American pros sort of left Magic and went to play poker. And they all come back, right? Magic is just the best game. It's sort of the ultimate test for all the gamers about who's the best. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I wish I could be in that arena trying to prove myself again.
And I was reading your Hall of Fame profile, and you specifically thanked your wife, Del, for being, as you said, remarkably patient and supportive. And you said that she's been by your side since the beginning. What was it like trying to juggle, you know, dating, courting, marriage, having a family with playing competitively and then doing everything you did at WOTC? You know, you were doing, from what I understand, you were doing a podcast, I think, or an audio.
Well, I mean, I did lots of things. I mean, it helped that sort of she and I met and fell in love and got engaged before I ever qualified for a pro tour. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was already married when I won the pro tour. So that juggling might not have worked out as well otherwise. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like that's something we don't really see. You know, like I do feel like there is very much that stereotype of the, you know, the college kid, the bachelor. I mean, they might be in like relationships, but I really don't know of many married gentlemen who've hit the big time. And I would imagine that that's a lifestyle you have to get used to.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is. I do think if magic didn't exist when I was in high school, but it hadn't been invented yet, I mean, it's possible that if I'd gotten sucked into a competitive outlet like magic then, you know, my life just wanders off in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. So, and you also have a daughter?
I do.
And does she play?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's funny. Okay. She sees magic as the game mom works on, which is always kind of funny to me.
Does she know anything about Randy Buehler?
Yeah, I mean, she does now. She's nine now. Okay. But, like, at six, it was the game that mom did. It was the thing that mom did at work. Mm-hmm.
So if your daughter continued to play and your daughter said to you one day, Dad, I want to do what you did. I want to be on the pro tour. What would you say to her?
She's already figured out that Del's job means she's not allowed to either.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
But if she could, would you support that?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah, no, it's a great game. It's a great game. It's a great social scene.
I look forward to seeing that. I would love to see, I feel like a lot of my friends are reaching that age where they're starting to have children now. And my good friend Jen, who I have on the show often, she has a little boy who we call Tuk Tuk, after Tuk Tuk the Explorer. And she's already started buying him boxes and promos and binders. And I look forward to seeing the next generation where, you know, let's say Chapin has a child or let's say LSV has a child. I look forward to seeing that 2.0 take the stage, and I want to be around for that. I think that's going to be awesome to see.
Yeah, Kiri definitely, she dabbles in it. She's not, it's funny, she's definitely got some of my competitiveness in her, but I mean, the fact that she can't win it consistently at Magic without a handicap, I think actually turns her off on it a little bit. But I always try to set up games where, you know, I give a handicap where I'm not going to lose. I don't want to be losing on purpose, so I try to give her a handicap so that it makes for a fair game, but. Anyway, yeah, my current commander deck is very much her commander deck. Yeah, we had, like, one of the, you know, we'll often bring home the box sets, like dual decks will come home from the office with Del, or, like, the plane chase decks came home. And so the best of these decks for Kira, there's a plane chase deck from the original plane chase printing, which it's essentially a creature enchantment deck, right? It's, you know, before Bestow even existed. But, I mean, it's creatures and ways to make them gigantic by putting awesome creature enchantments on top of them. And so,
is that the green-white one?
Yeah, it is. It's like Savage Auras, I think.
Lots of totem armor.
Yeah. That's the one.
Yeah. Okay,
oh, so
I have
know
that.
The deck. Yeah, so that has been Kira's favorite deck. So I set about trying to build – and then the Commander product came home. And so we set about trying to build a Commander deck, which was essentially that theme. And so, yeah, that's my current Commander deck. It's awesome.
Very cool. So what's next for you, Randy? Do you have any other interests you're cultivating, any other projects you're working on? What's going on in your world right now?
I mean, when I left Wizards, I was definitely felt like there was an opportunity to do online trading card games. I mean, my last couple years at Wizards, I had been trying to lead an expansion into digital games, which I was too ambitious for Wizards. I mean, Wizards is, at its core, a tabletop gaming company, right? It's got a couple of awesome brands, and those brands should be extended in the digital realms, but like trying to develop an expertise in actually creating digital games is just, it's hard. It's a lot harder than we thought it was going to be. And so, I mean, that project essentially died and then the economy fell apart and whatever. I think Wizards was correct to just essentially cut that, what was it, too aggressive of an expansion project anyway. But that didn't mean there wasn't an opportunity. And so, you know, I hooked on with an indie dev studio for a couple of years, trying to make online trading card games. And we did some good stuff. We built an online version of Pokemon. We built an online version of Kaijudo for Wizards. But, I mean, those sort of small dev studios, you always wind up on this sort of treadmill where you're trying to keep the money coming in, falling off to get something. We never managed to launch anything original. So that company ran out of money. And, you know, that's when I got back into coverage, essentially, you know, I found myself without a full-time job. And, you know, I talked to Greg Collins, and he's like, yeah, why don't you come back? And we've been looking to get, you know, some more expert voices into the commentary booth anyway. And now I'm sort of at this point where, like, it's way more fun than having a real job. So I'm essentially a consultant at this point. You know, I have a number of companies I've been consulting for. I mean, as a trading card game expert, I mean, that's expertise that companies like to tap into from time to time. And it also sets it up such that I can have this lifestyle where, yeah, I can just go to events on the weekends. And I don't have a full-time job, but that's fine. I mean, maybe I could make more money if I had a full-time job, but it's way more fun to just talk about Magic on the weekends and have a good excuse to have to play Magic during the week.
So before we wrap this up, Randy, I want to know, what is one thing about you that you think we should know or that we don't know about you that has nothing to do with Magic?
I have no idea.
Because so much of your identity does revolve around Magic. So are there any other interests? Do you like to cook? Do you bite your toenails? Anything weird?
Well, I mean, anybody who follows me on Twitter will tell you that every August I start spouting gibberish about the World Board Game Championships. I'm looking forward to that in August. Yeah. There's nothing on the line there, right? It's just people playing board games for plaques. There's not a single dollar of prize money, but I've made a ton of tremendous friends through that. It's funny. I saw a Magic player. I remember this guy named Shadow Detella, who I lost to at Pro Tour New York in 1999. And my deck was better than his. I had this gorgeous sort of red-blue, like, all kinds of shocks and ways to kill things. And, you know, Cloud Spirits, nice sort of 3-1 high flyer. And he plays – oh, God, what was the card called? He plays Pincher Beetle against me. 3-1 untargetable for 2 and a green. And yeah. I'm looking at a handful of burn spells and a handful of flyers that can only block flying creatures. And I die to this friggin' Pincher Beetle with this, like, gorgeous deck. We both finished in the money, but, like, I always remembered this guy. So anyway, I saw a website about these board gaming tournaments, and there's Shadow holding this, like, giant trophy, having, you know, won best of show or whatever. I gotta go to one of these. So anyway, Shadow is one of my best friends at this point now. I play board games with him all the time and play online. Anyway, yeah, the Board Game Championships this year is actually immediately after Pro Tour Magic 2015 in Portland. So okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go to the Pro Tour, and I'll do commentary on Friday and Saturday. And then I have a Saturday night red eye to Philadelphia because I start competing in the first event of the World Board Gaming Championships right about the time the Top 8 is kicking off back in Portland.
Yikes.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sort of glad it worked out that I'm able to do both. I mean, the one red eye fly stitches. I'm disappointed not to do the top 8 in Portland, but I'd be even more disappointed not to get to play WBC this year.
And what games will you be playing there?
So the tournament is essentially 125 simultaneous board game tournaments. Like, wow. Each of those tournaments is, you know, there'll be a couple of heats, 2 or 3 heats, and then if you do well in the heats, then you advance to the semifinals. It's typically the format, you know, when the semis go to the final, when the finals you win. The first event I'll be playing in is Through the Ages, which is kind of a civilization-building board game, which is one of the best board games made in the last, maybe ever. It's spectacular. Agricola is another game that I play a lot of that I expect to be competing in. Vegas Showdown. I play a lot there. Turning Taxi, St. Petersburg. I think those are all games that I've won at various points in the last 4 years.
Nice. So are there games like, are we talking like the fancier games, like Settlers of Catan, Agricola, anything like that?
Sure. Well, Agricola is there. I think it's Agricola, but I'm honestly not sure.
Oh, you say Agricola?
I do say Agricola.
Interesting.
I've heard people say it both ways. I honestly don't know which one's right.
Wow. I'm so curious now because I always thought it was Agricola.
Settlers of Catan is kind of a gateway game. Like, Settlers of Catan at this show is the thing they do on Saturday for the people who only come for the weekend.
Oh.
That's sort of the gateway. That's the easy stuff. You know, and Carcassonne is another gateway game. You know, Dominion is on the easier side of what gets contested here. It's mostly sort of medium to hardcore Euros. Mm-hmm. Although, to be fair, I mean, there's also some fun stuff. Like, you know, there'll be the late night Liar's Dice game. There'll be the late night Can't Stop game where 200 people are simultaneously rolling dice and shouting at the top of their lungs.
So if I were to show up on Saturday and say, you know, I'm here to play Dominion, would I get a little bit of side eye or?
No, it's fine. I mean, okay. I am, look, on the scale from casual gamer to hardcore, I reckon I'm way over on one extreme. And at the WBC, the majority of the people there are, you know, relatively local. They're within driving distance, and they just showed up to play games for fun. And then there's, you know, maybe 100 of us that are sort of super hardcore and fly in from all over the world because we like to compete for titles. Mm-hmm. Something like that. Anyway, so, yeah, you asked me what the one thing is. I have won the Caesar Award for it's essentially the Board Game Players Association's Player of the Year trophy. I won that
wow.
2 years in a row. I won 11-12 and then 12-13.
The Caesar Award.
The Caesar.
That's an interesting name.
Yeah, they call it the Caesar. And then the console is usually who has the best week for just the week of WBC.
Wow. I mean, is there anything you're not good at?
Yeah, sure. All kinds of stuff.
It just sounds like everything, like I'm thinking back on, you know, everything you've done. And it just sounds like you've been good at everything you've tried.
I don't know that that's true. I mean, I certainly tend to be tunnel vision focused. Like I'm not very good at doing things part way. If I'm going to get into something, I'm going to get hardcore into it, and I'm going to focus on it. I'm going to spend all of my time and energy trying to find ways to get good at it. I mean, that's just mm-hmm. that's how I work, I guess.
Well, I should probably start doing that then. Maybe I could get a fraction of that. You know, I'd be happy with that. So Randy, if anybody's enjoyed listening to you on the show, where can they find you? How can they get a hold of you?
Twitter is probably the easiest way, and just R. Bueller.
Okay.
And then, you know, Magic Coverage, that's where I am easiest to find, I guess.
But don't say hi on the Twitch stream because you won't see it.
Right, yeah, hit me on Twitter.
Well, Randy, this has been a pleasure getting to know you, and I look forward to seeing you. I'll actually be at I have two more GPs coming up. I will be in Chicago and Boston. So.
Yeah, I won't be in Chicago, but I will be in Boston.
Okay, well, I will definitely have to give you a wave while I'm there, and I'm really glad that we got to do this. Thank you.
Thank you. It was fun.
Yeah. And if anyone has enjoyed what you've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is available on iTunes and Stitcher. Please subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. If you want to keep up with happenings on the show, you can follow it on Twitter at the Deck Tees. You can follow me on Twitter at OriginalEstrus, or you can email me personally at Estrus@ElitistRex.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye!